For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson with the latest readout video from our free Wednesday Wake Up email newsletter, and also hey to viewers in Denmark who've made it number 12 on our all-time list of views by jurisdiction, which is not hey. Then we sneer at the notorious climate alarmist prediction from 2000 by David Viner of the Climatic Research Unit of the University of East Anglia. Yes, that's the CRU of subsequent ClimateGate infamy, that, quote, children just aren't going to know what snow is, end quote. And honestly, we're grateful to the author of that prediction, not just for placing a large, juicy fish in a small, shallow barrel, but because too much climate alarmism consists of predictions too vague or distant to be tested, thus making a mockery of the scientific method while claiming to champion it. This prediction was direct, concrete, and verifiable. Or, to get technical about the philosophy of science, falsifiable. And guess what? It got falsified. They do know. Now, in the spirit of fairness, his prediction concerned Britain specifically, which has not been an especially snowy place since the end of the Little Ice Age in the mid-19th century, so it too should have been one of those fish barrel deals. Instead, we let off this newsletter item with, well, very cold and snowy conditions in Britain. But we didn't stop there, including, quote, a winter storm warning has been issued to over 20 million people in the northeast on Friday, as several areas could see their largest snow totals in over 3 years, end quote. So, kids know snow in New England, too. And in Europe, where Ryan Mauer asks, quote, when's the last time it snowed this much in Europe? The Little Ice Age? Woolly mammoths will be surveying the glacial landscape in the coming weeks, end quote. So, how often does a theory notoriously weak on predictions have to muff the ones that it does make before even its adherents start blushing? Or are those red cheeks just frostbite? But science is pretty much done, they tell us. Evidently Donald Trump isn't just attacking Iran's nukes or the Venezuelan president. He's going after science itself, and it's close to finished. In fact, our friend Roger Pilkey Jr. just put out his top 5 climate science scandals 2025, and one of them, at number 3, is, quote, the Trump administration's campaign of vengeance as science policy, end quote. And we are genuinely sympathetic to Pilkey Jr.'s concerns. But we also think that if climate science had wanted to avoid the public coming to hate it and cheer its demise, it would have avoided polemical blunders like RPJ's other scandals, including, quote, an undeniably fake data set used in research and promoted in assessments, end quote, or the U.S. National Climate Assessment being horribly politicized by Trump's predecessor Joe Biden and the usual suspects not objecting. As Pilkey Jr. has himself asked on this subject, what did we expect would happen? And we at CDN ask, now that the predictable has arrived, have they learned any lessons that might help make it stop? Or will they go right on politicizing things like bureaucratic reorganizations of American weather forecasting and call it, quote, scientists say, end quote, or, quote, experts say, end quote? And unfortunately, so far, the answer seems to be a resounding yes. And with friends like that, you don't need enemies. And now, a word from our sponsor, which, as always, is you. And I've mentioned before, I feel a bit awkward asking for money. I figure people don't like being asked. We understand that many of you are giving what you can, and we get letters from people saying, gee, I wish I could do more, but I'm on a fixed income, I've got a family to feed. So, again, we're so grateful to everybody who gives, whether it's $2 a month, or one time $50, one time £75. But we are up against very well-funded, government-funded climate alarmists. So if you value our work and you haven't already made a contribution, please do become a sponsor. $2 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month, whatever you can afford, so that we can get back to doing what we love best, which is this. In the newsletter, we also note that in Northern Hemisphere summer, media outlets are prone to hyperbole like scorch and soar to describe warmth. But then, watching freezing rain somehow descending on Ottawa, even though the thermometer read -9 Celsius, we got to thinking about how rarely stories mention temperatures plunging or things being frostbitten, even though the winter has been, well, so wintry that even Wenceslas would have put on an extra cloak before venturing out. We also ridiculed the heat map daily writer, who is also, quote, the front person of a band called Echo Astral, end quote, about how, quote, I expected touring the whole country with my rock band could change me. I didn't think it would shatter my understanding of the U.S. energy transition, end quote. Evidently, he or she, and in fact it is she, proud owner of a B.A. in English Language and Literature, so not a climate scientist, saw how splendidly wind and solar were blanketing the country, so that didn't really shatter her preconceptions, did it? But she was briefly embarrassed, though only briefly, to be seeing it from a gas-powered car because, quote, the sheer logistical requirements of going electric would be difficult for any touring band, end quote. Oh, that. You tell us the stuff works great, but then say, not in my case, because there's one rule for thee, peasant, and one rule for me, creative genius with a conscience. On the plus side, the BBC More or Less podcast churned out some orthodoxy on global warming before saying that RCP 8.5 was rubbish, quote, in hindsight, end quote. Though we say it was also rubbish in foresight, and we ask why the scientists who say didn't say so before it became painfully obvious. Oh, and Euronews reports that, quote, EU legislators agreed this week on a historic deal to end energy dependency on Russian gas by 2027, end quote, with Energy Commissioner Dan Jorgensen insisting that, quote, even when there's peace, we won't buy Russian gas again. We should never repeat the mistake of becoming dependent of Russian gas again, end quote. All of which is very true and commendable. But has it dawned on Jorgensen and his colleagues that they must get reliable, affordable energy from somewhere? Or is it just one more step in reducing Europe to a hungry and helpless sideshow by getting rid of what works and still strutting about as if he were at the Congress of Vienna and bestrode the world like a colossus? And another thing, if we're all going to die from climate disasters, we'd better do it and decrease the surplus population. But, alas, instead, Roger Pilkey Jr. writes, quote, congratulations, world! Globally, 2025 had one of the lowest annual death rates from extreme weather in history, end quote. Which raises the question whether governments, including the Canadian, will go right on churning out press releases about the rising human as well as financial cost of the supposedly relentless increase in disastrously bad weather. Celebrate the decline? Not on your life. But it's not all doom and sneers in the newsletter. Instead, we note with pleasure a Toronto Star story about Toronto renaturalizing the mouth of the Don River and getting, quote, a flood of flora and fauna not seen in decades, end quote. It just shows what can happen when effort and money are directed to real environmental problems, not the carbon pollution that actually feeds such wetlands. On the other hand, the Manhattan Contrarian continues to dissect the green energy disaster in New York, where the Dreamers intended to overcome the problems that they finally noticed with wind and solar by creating, quote, large grid-scale battery storage facilities, end quote, but haven't done the math on how much they'll need, hint, it's more than they can get, or done a safety check on the tendency of such batteries to catch fire and burn horribly. Which is important to the overall story because of the strange combination of conceit and ineptitude among such persons. Thus, here in Canada, columnist Laurie Goldstein notes, Canada's new and supposedly improved climate zealot Prime Minister Mark Carney admits that, quote, Canada is not going to reach our 2030 and 2035 climate targets, end quote. But Carney campaigned on meeting them. So, did he not do the math, or did he do it and then lie? But never mind, because it's all together now, all Trump's fault. The Economist, the climate issue, bids 2025 farewell with, quote, it has been a rocky year for climate, starting with Donald Trump's renewed residency in the White House and the resulting dismantling of American climate policy, end quote. The New York Times Climate Forward warns of, quote, how Trump's first year reshaped U.S. energy and climate policy, end quote. And Canary Media deplores, quote, Trump's year of offshore wind carnage, end quote. But here's the problem. If all this stuff were working half as well as these people promised over the last 20 years, how could one obtuse politician make it all stop so quickly? And why are voters okay with the change, not just in America, but across the democratic world? It simply doesn't make sense unless you accept that the green energy transition is a bust. Look. Here at CDN, we're not naive about politics, including, yes, voters. But unless Jay Budziczewski is right that people are logical, if slowly, then self-government itself is illogical. Whereas if people are logical, however slowly, then when a political craze peters out, you have to give some credit to citizens having noticed that it wasn't working very well in practice. But a lot of climate alarmists, like many of the anointed, despise normal people. Speaking of which, a Bloomberg feature begins, quote, "In the dark, chilly winter months, it's not uncommon to walk down one of London's more affluent residential streets without noticing the smell of wood smoke. Bittersweet and pungent, the odor typically comes from an appliance that has become the epitome of British middle-class aspiration, the wood-burning stove," end quote. Ah, right out of Dickens, isn't it? Well, perhaps Bleak House or some such. Because it turns out that while wood fires are charming, and indeed they're carbon neutral, for those who care about that sort of thing, the activists are now saying that wood smoke will kill us all, and the government is therefore thinking of banning them, along with gas stoves, gas furnaces, water heaters at work, and other frivolous upper-middle-class status symbols. But the killjoys aren't done yet. Just as the heat goes off in your house, your active snarls that, quote, "your ugly Christmas jumper is part of an environmental disaster," end quote. There really is no pleasing some people, and it's a mug's game to try. In the newsletter, we also continue our deep dive into this summer's DOE report by looking at Chapter 4 on climate sensitivity, which points out, uncomfortably for the settled science crowd, that estimates of the warming response of the atmosphere to increasing CO2, which is at the very core of the climate issue, are still all over the place, even after 40 years of research and billions of dollars spent. So not only is the science not settled, it's not settling. And it gets worse. We often hear the charge that so-and-so is not a climate scientist, so their view should be ignored. And we often point out in reply that neither are Al Gore and Greta Thunberg, which doesn't seem to stop climate activists from hanging on their every word, or those of Antonio Guterres, or, on climate at least, the Pope. But the other important rebuttal to that charge is that sometimes the analysis needs a different skill set than a PhD in meteorology, climate modeling, or even atmospheric physics. And nowhere is that more likely to be the case than when a debate hinges on statistical analysis. In which case, someone with a PhD in statistics or econometrics is exactly the sort of person that you should listen to. Which brings us to a new paper by Rice University economist Dr. Peter Hartley, which uses methods familiar to people in econometrics and finance to analyze whether CO2 and temperatures move together over time, which is, of course, what climate theory says they ought to do. But they don't, Hartley finds. Despite what you've heard, including from a lot of people with extremely shaky math backgrounds and no corresponding humility, if CO2 really were the control knob on the planetary thermostat, then the temperature data would look very different than it does. But since Hartley's not a climate scientist, just an expert on something crucial to climate science, we are 100% confident that his results will be ignored by the IPCC and the climate experts, even if they do look at it and manage to understand it. Finally, from the co2science.org archive, the Latin version of this week's plant sounds like something an astronomer would come up with, Galactia Eleoti, or perhaps a battle star. But the name has nothing to do with galaxy or galactica, except that Galactia is Greek for milky, from which the Milky Way gave way to galaxy. But we digress. The point is, this etymologically fascinating plant grows in southeastern American states like Florida, and it adds nitrogen to the soil, so Eliot's milk pea, its common name, is good for other plants around it, and CO2 is good for it. In 1999, a study found that exposure to an extra 300 parts per million of atmospheric CO2 caused a 110% growth boost to seedlings in an open-top chamber as they reached for the stars. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, not wondering what this cold white gunk falling from the sky could possibly be.